Hello and welcome. You're listening to the Theology at the Pub Melbourne podcast. Theology at the Pub is a monthly event hosted in Melbourne. For more information and to find out about our upcoming events, follow us on Facebook, Instagram, or visit us at theologyatthepub.com.au. Grab yourself a drink and enjoy the talk.
Now you were going to record this, so is that you've got it there? It's clear enough?
Yeah.
Okay. All right, so if I talk for about 20 to 30 minutes and then I think the custom is to have some questions, to have a bit of a downtime and some questions, so I'm happy to answer any of the questions related to the topic or otherwise. So, I've been extremely blessed in my life. I've had 27 years of formal education. And I don't want to sort of pour water on the evening, but I had to pay for none of it. It probably will never happen again in history. So I had the 7 years in primary school. I had the 6 years in high school. So I went to a Catholic primary school. My parents paid for that. I went to a state high school for 4 years, which was a very good experience for me, in a little place called Cooma, which is in New South Wales in the Snowy Mountains. And I went to a boarding school in Sydney, St. Joseph's, for 2 years. My mum and dad paid for that. I went to a secular university and did an honours degree in finance. And I paid for none of that, except for the textbooks, the expensive textbooks in finance. And I got a scholarship in one of the university colleges, which was good. And about halfway through this idea that I was going to try and make some money in life by doing finance, I felt the call to be a priest. I don't know why, but I did, and I was lucky enough to have the grace to answer it. Best thing I ever did. I would never have known life to be this exciting as a priest. I would have been boring in finance. It would have been incredibly boring, and just making money would have been like a treadmill, but being a priest has been a fantastic thing. So I went into the seminary, and that was for 6 years. That was all paid for by the Archdiocese of Canberra Goulburn. And then I was lucky enough to be offered the chance to do graduate study after the initial philosophy and theology in Washington, D.C., as you just heard. And so I did firstly a license in the theology, and then I did the doctorate, and that was a great gift. And the doctorate was on the theological meaning of money. So when I studied the church's social teaching, I thought there was a great emphasis on social justice, but I thought someone's got to do some work here on the meaning of business, because if you don't generate money, you can't share the money. So this is an idea. Money doesn't come out of thin air. So that's my background, and I've been a priest now for 33 years and feel very blessed. And of recent time, I came across this extraordinary five-volume work on Australian political and cultural history by a guy called David Kemp, who is a minister in the government of John Howard. Five volume. The first volume is called The Land of Dreams, published in 2018. And I picked it up, I saw it advertised, saw a book review, went and bought it, started to read it, and I thought, this is really incredible stuff, but it's very, very academic and very heavy. So I thought, someone's got to translate this into language that people like yourselves can read, everyone. So I went and did a sabbatical last year for 3 months. I went up to Brisbane and I sat down. I got up at 5 o'clock every morning, started reading, worked pretty hard. And then when I was ready, I'd write each of the chapters. So I've written this little book called Australia, What Went Right and What Went Wrong. The book was originally going to be called Australia, What Went Right. But as I did the history, I began to realise, no, Australia's not a perfect society. It's one of the best modern societies, probably the best modern society. But it's not perfect, so that's the title of the book. The book has an introduction, and then it has three chapters in it. Okay, so the basic idea that Kemp has is this. If I can leave you with one abiding thought, this would be it tonight. That when the founders of Australia set out to set up the society which we now have, and I'm speaking about from 1788, we'll come back to the Aboriginal question a little bit later. But when we come to that, the founders of Australia, they said, look, what we want is a free and fair society. We don't want the British model, the aristocratic conservative model where a few people have the power and the wealth and no one else has access to it. That's not going to be any good at all. So the Scottish were very influential in helping the founders understand this key idea. And on the other hand, we don't want utopian socialism. Because what happens with socialism is you take away the right to initiative and therefore things collapse, wealth collapses. Now, you're all fairly young. You're a lot younger than I am. I'm going to be 60 on Saturday. It's hard to believe. And I'm warning you, Father, I'm warning them, as you know, between 40 and 60, I don't know what happens. It just seems to fly. But everything seems to be going a lot slower before then. But anyway, I'm going to be 60 on Saturday. So a lot of you probably wouldn't realise this in a sense. But socialism began in 1917 as a collective system. And by the time they finished in 1989, 1990, 1991, the whole thing, all those places that embraced socialism were living in abject poverty. It was absolutely horrific. Now, I'll come to the prediction by the Pope in a minute. The Pope, he was the first truly modern Pope. So the book has this basic introduction. It introduces it with this basic idea that Australia, the founders deliberately, purposely set out to say, we want a free and fair society. We don't just want a free society. We want a free and fair society where everyone gets a chance to have access to the wealth. And for those that don't have access to the wealth, we want to lift them up. So we've had natural mechanisms as we've gone down our country's history, and the natural mechanisms are in medicine and in health. So we have a very good medical system. It's not perfect, but it's one of the best in the world. It's a mixture of public and private, and the same applies in education. It's a mixture of public and private, which really helps the country do well in lots of ways. So you can be looked after far better in this country than most countries in terms of your health, and your opportunities for education are far better. So we've had these natural mechanisms which have fitted the basic paradigm that they wanted. So as I looked at the beginnings of Australia from 1788 onwards, and as I looked at Kemp's work, David Kemp, K-E-M-P, I began to realise that the best way to do this was to look at the governors of Australia. So the very first governors, because the governors all had this idea, we want a free and fair country. So for instance, they rejected out of hand the whole idea that we would have slavery in this country, which is very different to the United States, very different to the UK, very different to most modern countries. The idea was we are not going to touch slavery in any fashion. We came close to it with the Polynesians up in Queensland towards the latter part of the 19th century, but it was rejected. Came close because they were struggling to get people to get up there to do the work that needed to be done up there, but nevertheless they rejected it. So I began to realise the best way to write the history was to focus on these figures. And in that's the chapter two that you'll read in the book. But then I began to realise that Kemp probably hadn't done enough work, in my humble opinion, which is not very humble and not much of an opinion. But anyway, so I began to realise that we needed to look at what happened with the interplay between church and state from the time of Christ up to the point of 1788. So I did a chapter one on that, and that I think is quite an important chapter, because there you'll realise when you read it that in fact the Christian faith has had a profound influence on the history of the world. I'll give you a couple of examples. The first one is in the area of freedom. So we know that Christ died for us and rose from the dead. And we furthermore know that a lot of people after him, who were called the martyrs, did the same thing. They gave their life freely. And this has had a major impact on the way we understand human freedom. Human freedom is not just about going into a supermarket and choosing what you want. And our freedom's at a deeper level, which is basically saying, I can use my freedom to surrender myself to something that's higher and better than I am. So we do this in marriage, we do it in religious life and in our faith. And when we start to take our faith, we'll say, hang on, there's something bigger than me here. So that is a very big influence. Furthermore, when the ancient pandemics went through society, the Christians rose to the occasion. Because they really loved one another, they were very practical at dealing with pandemics. So when the pandemic had gone through society, they were the ones that looked after people better, therefore they had far better retention rates. So at the time the pandemic finished, there were a greater proportion of Christians still alive because they actually loved one another. The second point, and this is probably going to come as a little bit of a shock, but one of the reasons why the Christian faith really took off is because of the teaching on marriage and family. So the teaching was really clear that the man had to be faithful. And this was very unusual in the ancient world. Now, he was an insistence that the man had to be faithful to his wife. There'll be no divorce. There'll be no abortion. There'll be no infanticide, and contraception certainly discouraged. So as a consequence of that, Christian families were far more stable and they had far more children. And so as a consequence of that, the Christians went up like that compared to all the others. I mean, it's good to know, for instance, that the Roman emperors, they were decreeing that men should get married because the marriage rate had gone off the cliff, a bit like what we're experiencing in Australia at the moment. Anyway, by 323, so by 311, 313, the emperor said, right, you Christians, you can have your way, you can practice your faith, no more persecutions. By 10 years later, all the coins in the empire had, every single one of them, both sided, had Christian inscriptions on them. So the movement was rapid and it was profound because of those two reasons. Three reasons. One, because of the freedom, people actually really believe what they were taught and lived their life, surrendered their life. Secondly, because of their love for each other, practical love. And thirdly, because of this mysterious teaching on marriage. So their clear idea, well, marriage is derived from God and marriage is directed to God. That's why it's so sacred and sacrosanct. And it'd be a really good thing, Father and others here, to rediscover some of these beautiful teachings about Christian marriage. I spoke to Clara, where are you, Clara? Over there. I spoke to Clara before about John Paul II and his theology of the body, which I studied at length in the United States, and I wrote a little book called The Theology of the Body Made Simple. This, what he put forward, the Pope, is incredible in terms of understanding who you are as a human being and what your body means and therefore what sexuality means. It's not a moralistic thing. It's really quite a deep insight into who we are as human beings through human experiences. So that was the first chapter of the book. Just before I leave that first chapter, people like the Benedictines. You're familiar with the Benedictine order? The Benedictines are incredible. They've got the first truly monastic rule that persists today. And they were the men and women who really put together theoretical knowledge and practical knowledge. Until that time, until the time of Christ, there was a great bias. If you did intellectual work, that's it, you were the really smart ones. If you did manual work, you were the slaves. But of course Christ, with his 25 years of working away in Nazareth as a carpenter, put all that notion to bed. So that what the Benedictines did, they said, when the freedom came, they said, look, let's put together a rule of life that combines theoretical knowledge and practical knowledge. So they were really the first modern inventors of science. So between the 6th and 17th century, 15th century, extraordinary inventions, most of them agrarian, that's true, came true. How to harness horsepower, for instance. And this is a time of immense development while the world sort of collapsed, with the Roman Empire collapsing. Then the universities came. The universities came, what century? You know, the 11th century, the church created universities. And by the 15th century, there were 72 of them. And this served society enormously. So the universities that you now have, the way they're structured, the independence they have, all came with the church. It's important to know it. So my big concern is, and will be that in our education system, a lot of these information pieces of information are not well known, they should be made available to you. So the book tries to make it available to you. It's an 18,000 word little monograph. All right, after the governors, so by 1901 Australia became a federation, which is an incredible achievement. It looked like they weren't going to get it, but they got it. They were very sensible, and we created a federation out of all of the states. So then I simply asked the question, well, okay, what went right, what went wrong? And one of the things that clearly went right was the Constitution. It is probably one of the best constitutions in the world. There's no doubt about this. Better than the American Constitution. Our system of government, I think, is better, but that you can argue the point if you like. But to this point, we have had the most stable government, stable governments of any countries in the world, really, and it's still persisting. But it's not an automatic. What went right also was the generation of wealth. Australia was exceedingly wealthy by the end of the 19th century, despite a big drought and despite a big problem with debt. And the distribution of wealth was unprecedented right across the country. So the access to the wealth was magnificent. What went wrong? The Aboriginal question, undoubtedly. So you won't find, except perhaps in Tasmania, governments saying go ahead and slaughter Aboriginals, but on the frontiers it's very true that there was a lot of death. So Kemp cites, for instance, in 1788, when the British came to the country, there were possibly between 300,000 and 700,000 Aboriginal people. We don't know, essentially, but between 300 and 700,000. By 1901, there was about 120,000. That included intermarriage. So what would happen is that there, on the frontiers, there was a lot of violence and a lot of Aboriginals were killed. To this day, I think there's only one memorial. It's the Myall Creek Massacre in New South Wales. So that's a part of the history that went wrong. There's no doubt about it. The very first thing they did in Australia in the 1901 Parliament was institute what they call as the White Australia Policy. Now, they really believed in this free and fair country, but for some unknown reason, they were colourblind. And you had these statements by some of them saying, look, you know, the white man is far more superior to someone of different coloured skin. Well, they got that wrong, obviously, but by the middle of the century, they'd sorted that out and said, look, this is ridiculous, let's forget that. So it's not perfect, that's for sure. But basically today, we have still one of the freest and fairest countries on earth, and it's really now your generation that has to carry it through. So the book is an attempt to say, look, don't be afraid to get into political life and public life. By public life, I mean all those things like in health and education, these sort of more public type occupations and vocations. It's really important for people of your calibre to get into them to make a difference. Life, you've got to make enough money to live, I know, but life's not about just making money, as I discovered by becoming a priest. So that's why I wrote the book. And it's doing well, I think. People are reading it, but it's over to you to get it. And then I think to go back to the original document by Kemp and sort of say, what could we do with this to educate the next generations? Because I think at the primary level there's a challenge, at the secondary level there's a challenge, and then in the tertiary level there's a challenge as well. So that might do us for a little bit. Perhaps if I leave you with a thought when we come back for discussion. All right, if we were to carry forward this vision that that they had, the founders had, what have we got at our disposal? What sort of simple paradigm have we got at our disposal? So let me just say something here about the very first truly modern Pope, which was Pope Leo XIII. Who was elected in 1878 and died in 1903. At the time he was elected, he was 68. The cardinals thought they were electing someone to keep the seat warm, but he became the first truly modern pope in five different areas. Now, one of the challenges that they faced was the Industrial Revolution, which was sweeping the world and was with these marvellous new inventions. But what it was doing was making the wealth distribution very, very difficult. So it was landing in the hands of a few people, and a lot of other people were not having access to it. So a lot of people petitioned him to say, can you write a document that will actually help us go forward into the future? So he did. He consulted widely with a German theologian, and he produced this thing called Rerum Novarum. That's the Latin meaning of new things. And the two challenges that he faced were, one, the Industrial Revolution with the disparity of wealth, and secondly, the socialistic solution to it, saying, look, the best way to handle this is to socialise all the property. So he said, right, here's the document. So he wrote it in 1891. His first step, his first instinct was to say, look, we cannot have socialism. So he announced this incredible campaign and insight and argument to say, if you abolish the right to private property and private initiative, you'll never produce wealth. All you'll do is produce poverty, and that'll solve nothing. So by the communists took over in 1917, as I mentioned before, by 1989 to 1991, those countries collapsed and they were living in absolute poverty. So that didn't work at all. So his prophecy was absolutely spot on. Now, over that period from 1891 to now, which is basically 140 years, the church has developed the most magnificent social teaching. It's extraordinary. It's been possibly, in my opinion, possibly the most systematic development of church teaching the church has ever seen in its history. And what we have now is we have these four principles on which social life should, and political life and cultural life should be constructed. Here are the four principles, and I'll leave it with you. The first principle is the dignity and the freedom of the human person. That can never be compromised. So, you know, the commandments, the Beatitudes protect this. But in civil society, this is very important to help people see, no, the human dignity of one person has to be defended, their dignity and their freedom. The second principle is the common good, which people like yourself are going to have to reformulate a bit because it's been lost. At the moment, what we're getting is a whole collapsing to minority groups, which is not the common good. The common good is all those conditions, all the conditions, social conditions, economic conditions, political conditions, civil conditions, you name it, that allow the human person, the first one, to develop. It's very, very important. The third principle is the principle of subsidiarity. That is, you shouldn't let the government do what you should do. So this was articulated brilliantly 40 years after Leo's document in 1931 by Pius XI. And he basically could see that within society, a lot of these intermediary bodies like scouts, like churches, you know, tennis clubs, anything between government and the human person, all those intermediary groups were sort of collapsing. People were opting out of them. And he said, no. You've got to get involved in that. If you don't get involved, society won't be what we know it to be. I think that's very important, the principle of subsidiarity. And the final principle, which that one's orientated towards, is the principle of solidarity. That is, we have to care for one another, as I mentioned back in that first chapter, the love of the poor that the Christians had. So that seems to me to be a paradigm. Whether you happen to be a Greenie, a Liberal, a Labourite, you've got to see that we've got to try and have a common language in which everyone in society is going to benefit. The dignity of the human, the dignity and freedom of the human person, the common good, the principle of subsidiarity, don't take away people's freedom, encourage them to get involved, participation, and then solidarity. We've got to help each other. We can't do this on our own. So that is a really, I think, good paradigm in which we can go forward. So that might be a helpful discussion point at your tables, and then when we come back, we can discuss it. So I hope that's been helpful, not too full on.
Thanks for tuning in to this episode of Theology at the Pub. If you enjoyed the talk, let us know. Follow the podcast, leave a review, and share it with a friend. For our upcoming events, find us on Facebook, Instagram, or visit us at theologyatthepub.com.au. Until next time, God bless.